Welcome to Animal Airwaves Live here on WUFTFM. This is our weekly hour-long show devoted to the discussion of the health and welfare of animals. I'm Dana Hill, and I'm very happy to welcome back to the show from the UF College of Veterinary Medicine our friend Dr. Chris Sanchez. And we're going to be talking today about what's new in equine research and research that can help treat some problems that horses experience that we've discussed on the show before, things like colic and anhidrosis, but some other things as well. And I'm glad to have you along, and I'm glad to welcome you back to the show, Dr. Sanchez.
Thanks a lot, Dana. I'm really happy to be here.
Let's discuss the idea that this is some research that is underway, not really to benefit people, which is what a lot of people think of, I guess, when the idea of animal research comes up. You're talking about research done on animals that maybe helps doctors and clinicians develop new treatments and medications for people. This isn't really what we're talking about today. We're talking about the kind of research that is to help the animals themselves.
Right. So this is horses helping horses for the most part. And I think a lot of times when people think about research animals, they think about lab rats, or because, you know, a huge amount of work is done in rodents, so mice and rats and whatnot. And a lot of that's done to help people, which is extremely important. Don't get me wrong. But I think the area in which I work is research in horses to help horses. And some of that has crossover to people as well, because again, is it, you know, all species are different. And so mice and rats, as it turns out, aren't people. And so a lot of, you know, for years and years, we found out that what is true in a rodent isn't necessarily true in a human. And so a lot of the drugs and therapies and whatnot that work well in rodent models don't work well when it turns to people. And so some work that's been done in horses, you know, large animal species can be a lot closer to people. And so some work, like work in osteoarthritis or the horse, can be a good model, because arthritis in horses actually mimics, that occurs naturally in horses, actually mimics what happens in people pretty well. And so that can actually be a reasonable large animal model. But I think many of us that are equine veterinarians, and, you know, we spend our lives devoted to getting horses healthy and keeping horses healthy, as clinicians, we come across certain problems that either perplex us, or certain cases. There's always those cases where, you know, you wish you just knew more about a certain disease. And as clinician scientists, those are the questions that drive our research problems, or at least for many of us. And so I have the benefit of being able to be a clinician and also doing some research. And so those two things for me go really well together, because many of the research questions I've have stemmed from problems I've developed or has seen in the clinic. And so it's a way to kind of tie things back together.
In the course of doing the show over the years, I have had so many discussions about cats and dogs, animals that are so close to people that we keep in our homes and that we have domesticated over however many thousands of years of human existence. And I have always kind of been surprised when some of your colleagues will say, well, you know, we really kind of don't understand this aspect of it, why the cats don't seem to respond well to this. And I have also been amazed, but not really surprised, at how horses are have such a close relationship with people, and have, going back also for thousands of years, because in so many important ways, really, civilization wouldn't be where it is today without the horse. And I wonder, before we kind of get too deep into this, if we can talk about kind of the relationship that people have had with horses for all this time, and why it's kind of important, and whether or not maybe some of these problems, have they always existed as long as horses have existed?
That's a great question, to which I don't necessarily have a great answer. And I think there are certain things that can. And, like, for example, I'm on a graduate committee with a person it's a really, really cool project that's a collaboration between people at the faculty of the Florida Museum of Natural History and faculty at the College of Veterinary Medicine, where this graduate student is looking at the incidence of laminitis, or founder, in the equine fossil record. And so, as it turns out, horses have had evidence of chronic laminitis back centuries and centuries. And so some of those things that we think are a product of domestication have actually occurred for years. We just didn't necessarily know it. And so I think that some things, yes, some things, no. And I think that, you know, there's certainly many problems that are that happen as a result of domestication, or I know it happens in dogs, people, everything, you know, killing them with kindness and overconditioning, and horses that are overweight are certainly at risk for, just like people and dogs and everything else that's overweight are at risk for other problems. So some yes, some no.
Yeah. I mean, horses are amazing animals. Anyone who's ever spent time with horses will recognize this. And they have this really special relationship with people. They are such a useful animal, right? I mean, we acknowledge that we love our cats and dogs. And dogs, many dogs, are very useful animals and do helpful work for people. Cats probably don't do as much helpful work for people, except for maybe the kind of, I don't know, they make you feel good. I know my cat makes me pretty happy, but she doesn't really do any work that contributes to my life in any sort of helpful kind of way. Horses are really great animals because they do very helpful things for people. And of course, people use them for other reasons too. Many people just enjoy, you know, going for a walk with a horse, or many people race horses. Horses do all sorts of things, but horses are great, useful animals. And so I like this idea that people are really after answers to some of these problems that kind of plague horses, because it is important to kind of understand the problems and solve them when these animals do have such a special relationship with people.
Absolutely. And so, you know, I think it's important to understand that the vast majority of research progress happens in very small incremental steps. And I think one of my favorite quotes is from Albert Einstein, that says, if we knew what we were doing, it wouldn't be called research. And so, you know, I think that over the years, we've certainly had many questions, which from clinical cases, we have an impression on how things work. And then we do research to see if we're right or not. And sometimes we are, sometimes we're not. And you just never know until you ask the question. So I think that looking into many of these problems, like you said, my personal areas of research kind of fall into two areas, colic and pain management, which we've discussed quite a bit on the show previously. And then I also am very interested in foals. And so, you know, young horses. And so those are probably my two biggest areas of research. And I think that, you know, if we can talk about how research has helped us over the years, we've recently published some work in foals to show how much better we are now than we used to be. And so if we look at survival to discharge from the hospital back in the 80s, when kind of was the dawn of equine neonatology, so to speak, and the survival was in the mid 50%. So it was barely over a 50-50 shot that if your foal had to get hospitalized, that it was actually going to be able to make it home from the hospital. Whereas now we're in the mid 80s. Hmm. And most of that has been done because we've gotten better. And one of the best ways we get better is to look at what we're doing and see how we can improve. And so there's been quite a bit of work here and elsewhere looking at sepsis, and so bacterial infection in the blood in foals, which is one of the most important causes of illness and death in the young foal. And we've done a lot of work here, and other people have done work elsewhere to look at what bacteria are most common, what antibiotics work better, what we can do differently in those foals to survive, and some of the other things we've done in foals, again, here and elsewhere, is you used to think that foals were at a way higher risk of getting stomach ulcers than other age animals. And we've actually learned that ulcers are a big problem in horses of every age, and that in foals in adult horses, usually and in people also, it's related to pH of the stomach acid. And in foals, we think it might actually be more related to blood flow to the stomach. And that when foals get really, really sick, their blood pressure drops quite a bit. And one of the first areas that where blood flow is going to go down first is to the GI tract, because it preferentially is going to go to things that are more important: heart, lungs, brain. And so that we think that although we haven't proven that, we've shown that there's not as much of a link between ulcers and gastric pH in foals like there is in adult horses. And that's something that we wouldn't have known until we started looking and asking that question.
Do you think that there are problems in horses, things like you just mentioned with the foals and the ulcers, or things like colic, and you mentioned founder, and these problems, have they always been around? Have people always been attuned enough to the health of horses to recognize them?
I think many people have, and I think if you look at something like founder or laminitis, what's old is new again, and you know, I think, again, through research, and there's a guy named Chris Pollitt down in Australia that's done by far the most research into laminitis and has really taught us a lot. We've come all the way back around to one of the best things we figured out is that icing the feet is one of the best things you can do to help either prevent and or treat laminitis in the early stages. And that goes right back to in olden days, cowboys used to put foundering horses in ice cold mountain streams. And so as it turns out, those guys are pretty smart, and we've spent millions of dollars trying to figure out why that actually works.
And it was the cheapest answer the whole time.
Pretty much.
Yeah. This is fascinating. With some of these conditions, though, we're talking about life-threatening conditions.
Absolutely.
A horse that can't sweat is kind of in jeopardy.
Sure. And so anhidrosis or non-sweaters are a huge problem. And especially, Florida is kind of it happens the most in hot, humid climates where sweat is needed the most. And we're, anyone that's walked outside today knows we're in the epicenter of hot and humid. And so anhidrosis is a huge problem for health and welfare of horses in Florida. And one of the people that's, not that many people are doing research into anhidrosis, but one of them, Rob McKay, is here at the University of Florida. And they've just finished up a study looking at acupuncture and herbal medication to see if the effect of that on anhidrosis. Unfortunately, that didn't appear to show a particular benefit. But one of the other things that our group here at UF has done recently is kind of another tack on anhidrosis, which is there's a respiratory problem in foals, Rhodococcus equine pneumonia, that's a big cause of pneumonia in kind of weanling age foals. Well, the category of drug that's used to treat that, the macrolides, and so that's drugs like erythromycin, clarithromycin, azithromycin. Well, those drugs, treatment of foals with rhodococcus with those drugs, there's been an association between that and acute death and overheating. And, you know, those foals are sick, they have fevers. And so we didn't really know whether it was because from the rhodococcus or from the drugs, but we've actually done some work here, Dr. McKay and myself and some others at UF, and have found out that those drugs actually make the foals stop sweating. And the reason that they can die is if they're turned out and can't sweat, they overheat. And anhidrosis doesn't tend to occur in young foals, so that's not something people really thought about. But we've done work and shows that within the first day, like within 24 hours of therapy, those foals can't sweat. And that effect on sweating actually persists for quite a while beyond, like, days to weeks beyond the point at which you stop therapy. And so it's a really immediate, profound response in sweating that is associated with administration of erythromycin. And we've just done some other studies that aren't published yet to look at the effect of some of the other macrolide drugs.
So why would those drugs even be used if there's such a potential for a terrible effect like anhidrosis?
Because rhodococcus also can kill them. And so as it turns out, it's a pretty easy complication to avoid. And so if you keep them in a stall with a fan, they don't need to sweat. And so it's only when you turn them out in the hot direct sunlight where that's a problem. And so it's a pretty easy fix that while they're on treatment and for the first 2 weeks after treatment, you keep them inside during the hot part of the day. And most of the time they need to be inside anyway because they have pneumonia and they can't breathe particularly well. So it's a problem that is easily overcome with knowledge gained from this research. And so if you just know not to turn them out while they're being treated, then crisis averted and that problem can be avoided.
Well, let's talk then a little bit about how the treatment options for that condition, these drugs you just mentioned, came to the market without them kind of advertising that, hey, look, here's a really big potential side effect of this treatment, right? Did people know that by giving these horses these drugs, these horses were going to experience high incidence of anhidrosis.
No. So, I mean, these foals have been treated with this drug for decades, and we're just now figuring out why this problem, that this problem even happens. And so, you know, I think that that's, when you look for adverse effects, most of the time those animals are in stalls, and if they're in stalls, they don't need to sweat, so you don't see it. And so I think that, that's a great question, and it brings about some of the problems that we have, is that we all, you can't possibly predict all potential complications, and the way drugs get used in the field is not necessarily the way they get used in the initial setting. And so that's why adverse events get reported, so we can figure out what that happens. And I'm not to say the incidence of hyperthermia and death is not particularly high. You know, thousands of foals get treated, and it happens in a few. But if it happens to your foal, you don't really care about all the others where it didn't happen. It's your foal. And so by letting people know that this can be easily prevented, then hopefully we'll be able to help a lot of foals.
Let's talk a little bit about the kind of research that goes into creating treatments and, say, medications for horses in whatever kind of condition we're talking about. The drugs or the therapies, do they go through a kind of clinical trial process as drugs or therapies would in the case of human medicine?
Sure. And so I don't work for a drug company, and I nor do I work for the FDA. And so my knowledge of this is, you know, from a veterinary standpoint, many FDA-approved drugs are always the first line of treatment. It's pretty expensive to get a drug approved for use in a species. And so every drug that gets approved by the FDA, it's for a given species at a given dose for a given problem. So a drug can get approved in horses for the treatment of pneumonia. But then that's the actual label indication. But then to get it approved for every additional indication, that's more and more money and more trials. And so to get the same antibiotic that might be used in a foal for pneumonia approved in a foal for an infection somewhere else, that would be additional clinical trials and whatnot. So if you use it in the species in which it's labeled for a different reason, that's off-label use, but can be acceptable. And so when we talk about, just because of the money involved in human healthcare versus the money involved in equine healthcare, it's a small piece of the pie. And so many of the drugs we use are labeled for other species, mostly people, sometimes cattle, sometimes other things, but the pharmacokinetics, which is how the drug behaves in that body system, have been worked out. And so we can use that research to show, yes, this drug appears safe in a small number of animals, and this is the dose you need to reach the acceptable, what we call therapeutic level, in the target organ, whether it's lung, joint fluid, whatever. And so we can use that research to then use that drug in horses, even though it's not specifically approved for that. And so by law, if there is a drug approved for that problem in the horse, we need to use that drug first. But for that is probably less than 20% of the drug use we have, because we have a limited amount of drugs available for use in horses, more and more every day, but we're still somewhat limited.
You're listening to Animal Airwaves Live here on WUFT. I am Dana Hill, and I'm speaking with Dr. Chris Sanchez from the UF College of Veterinary Medicine. We're talking about what's new in equine research. You mentioned towards the beginning of the show, Dr. Sanchez, that mice and rats are used in research to develop new treatments and therapies, both for people and maybe even for, I don't know, animals. But when we talk about the unfortunate reality, which is that not all therapies that work well in mice and rats prove effective for other species, I wonder if there is a kind of similar, if there's any sort of like guesswork that goes into using treatments that might be, say, for cattle and trying it out on horses. When veterinarians or whoever tries to work on some of this, is it just in, I mean, how do you approach that, right? How would you approach using a drug that is not maybe indicated for a specific animal and use it effectively and safely?
That's a great question. And so usually, you know, the behavior of the species and kind of, you know, how different drugs work in different things. And so if you're going to look at a drug for, we've been talking about pneumonia, so I'll say pneumonia, for example. If you're looking at a drug for treatment of pneumonia, we know what bacteria are causing pneumonia in the species. So then you look at, we do what we call, you grow that organism in culture, and then you look at a sensitivity profile. So what antibiotics might work against that particular bacteria. So then you go through, all right, well, this is a common cause of pneumonia. This is how usually the antibiotics are sensitive or resistant. And everything we're doing, you want to try and use antibiotics that are have the what we call the narrowest spectrum, so that will kill the fewest bacteria possible. So it leaves the rest of the normal kind of good bacteria alone and only treats the bad bacteria. That's an oversimplification, but approximately, because and you want to make sure that you use an appropriate dose, because appropriate dosing and duration of therapy and using an appropriate spectrum is really important for preventing antimicrobial resistance, because we want the antibiotics we have to be able to work. And there's a lot of pressure on antibiotics, both in animal use and in human health. And we as veterinarians are very cognizant of the fact that antimicrobial stewardship is really important, and we're all in this together, and we want to make sure that the antibiotics we have will continue to work for years to come, both in horses, in which we're interested, but people as well.
Right. Of course, this is an issue that many of the listeners to this program will kind of understand, and you hear about this. I had read something just recently about antimicrobial hand soaps. Right. And the idea that we may think that we're doing a great job by killing the bacteria on our hands, because who wants to think about bacteria on the hands? But at the same time, these kinds of things might inadvertently contribute to the resistance that some bacteria will have towards the kinds of things that can kill off the harmful bacteria that we don't want. And with treatments like these, though, you know, you want to target the particular problem. You want to do it safely. You want to do it effectively. And I wonder if when you're going to give a course of treatment to an animal and you go for a certain dose thinking, okay, this is what I think it will take, is that kind of work done to determine what the correct dose is? Is that done before the drug makes it to the market officially, or is that done sort of after the fact by people out in the field who really are using it?
I would say both. And so to get it approved the first time, it has to be done before it gets to market. But then to use it in different species, then it gets done kind of after it's approved for use in something before it gets hopefully widespread use in other species.
And you say that a lot of these drugs come from the realm of human medicine?
Some of them do. And some of them are specifically targeted. I would say a lot of the antibiotics we use are targeted specifically for the veterinary market. But some in general.
So we know how challenging it is for pharmaceutical companies to get a drug to market. We know that there's a lot of research done at universities, just like here at the University of Florida, that leads to the development of treatments for all manner of diseases. We know that pharmaceutical companies have a lot of energy and resources devoted to getting patents and getting FDA approval. Is it similarly rigid for veterinary medicines, that is, medicines that we know are going to be used exclusively for animals? Is it similarly hard to get these drugs to market?
It is, and that's one of the, we're forever having to balance cost of therapy with and cost of treatment and cost versus disease itself. And so, yeah, it's pretty expensive to get drugs to market. But I would say that sometimes, just going back to the concept of what research has done to help horses, speaking with the specifically about pneumonia in foals and rhodococcus that we were just talking about and anhydrosis, another set of studies that's been done by a person that used to be here at UF but is now at University of Georgia in conjunction with some folks in Germany. We've known about rhodococcus for decades, and the pendulum had kind of shifted because foals can get so sick with rhodococcus to then screening them and treating them with antibiotics when they showed abscesses that you could see with an ultrasound machine before they got sick. And so the pendulum shifted to foals being really sick and then getting treated to foals getting treated before they got sick. But we never really knew which foals were going to get sick and which foals didn't. So they actually set up a series of three or four clinical trials at big farms in Germany, looking at hundreds of foals on a farm that had a high incidence of rotococcus pneumonia. And they actually found out that foals with up to a 10-centimeter total abscess diameter did just as well with a placebo as they did with antibiotics. And so many of the foals that we were treating, because we started ultrasounding, actually didn't need to get treated because their immune system could fight off the problem and they would do okay. And they worked it out that on this big farm that had several hundred horses, by not treating everything until they had a certain kind of minimum diameter of, or, you know, minimum number of abscesses on ultrasound, they could actually save the farm $500,000 a year just in antibiotics use alone, not to mention the time to ultrasound and treat and whatnot. So that was an awesome discovery where we thought we were doing a great job by ultrasounding, but as it turned out, we were giving antibiotics to a bunch of foals that we didn't need to. And so that's a really cool discovery that we've had here in the last couple of years.
Yeah, let's talk a little bit about some of the other work that is going on. I mean, there are problems that horses have that can be very life-limiting, right? And understandably, a cure or a treatment at least is sought in probably every one of these different kind of conditions and maladies that we were talking about. And there are probably, if I had to guess, different approaches being taken in all sorts of different places, right? One clinician at one veterinary college somewhere may be working on something, and another clinician, totally unrelated, might be working to combat the same disease or problem, but on a completely different approach. And I wonder if the community that is out there to discover and find cures and treatments, is there a lot of collaboration? Is there a lot of teamwork? Is there a lot of communication so that this isn't occurring just kind of in isolated places, but that people are sharing this information and achieving solutions better that way?
Absolutely. That's a huge part of research, is presenting that information at national and local, national and international meetings to let others aware of your findings, and then choose collaborations. Like I said, the study I just mentioned was a collaboration with people in Germany and in Georgia. And there's also some similar work that had been done almost along the same lines to show the same effect with some folks at Texas, again, with the folks in Georgia. So that, absolutely. And again, I said I do work with colic and work with foals. And for colic, there's actually an international equine colic research symposium that happens every 3 years, alternating between the U.S. and the U.K. So last year was the colic symposium in 2014. I believe it was the 12th one. And so there were 122 research presentations at that meeting. And the folks here from UF had about 8 of them. But that's taking kind of the best minds in all the people that are doing colic research around the world, bringing them together for 3 days in one spot to kind of talk it out and see who's doing what and see how we can do things better. Because, you know, sometimes you're sitting in the audience, you see a presentation, you're like, wow, I've thought that. Or alternatively, sometimes you're like, wow, totally didn't expect that. But then that sparks another thought, because, you know, a big part of doing research is being able to be creative and having things that are somewhat related but maybe a little bit different. So, like, for example, if there's a little bit of muscle physiology that could potentially relate to the muscle in the GI tract, so skeletal muscle versus muscle in the GI tract, and so different ways to approach different problems across body systems sometimes can be really interesting, or a problem that's worked in people, like people with inflammatory bowel disease, maybe that's something that can be applied to colic in horses or, you know, in different problems. And so a lot of times we take work that's happened in one problem, one species, whatnot, see if that can apply to a different situation or not. And, you know, sometimes we're right, sometimes we're wrong, but that's you never know until you look.
You're listening to Animal Airwaves Live here on WUFT-FM. This is our weekly hour-long show devoted to the discussion of the health and welfare of animals. I'm Dana Hill, speaking with Dr. Chris Sanchez. We're talking about what's new in equine research, and there's going to be so much more when we come back after this. Back to Animal Airwaves Live here on WUFT. This is our weekly hour-long show devoted to the discussion of the health and welfare of animals. I'm Dana Hill, and I'm here with Dr. Chris Sanchez from the UF College of Veterinary Medicine, and we're talking about what's new in equine research, and we're talking about the ways in which research is being done on horses, but to help horses. And before we left off, Dr. Sanchez, you were mentioning one of the things you study, which is colic. Right? This is a big problem for horses. And before we get into some nuts and bolts, can you just remind the listeners what colic is in horses and why it matters so much?
Sure. Colic is a broad term for abdominal pain. And most of the time in horses, that's coming from the gastrointestinal tract or GI tract. And colic and lameness are really the top two problems that affect adult horses worldwide. And colic is often... If for any of the listeners out there that have had a horse or owned horses for very long, they've probably had one that's colicked at some point in time. And most of the time, it can be fixed pretty easily. But some of the times, things can go wrong, and they need surgery because things get twisted or strangulated, or there's other problems that we can't just fix with medical therapy and need to go to surgery.
Mm. I was thinking about diseases and treatment of diseases and how it can be one thing if you're looking for treatments or cures for a disease for which you know the cause, and another thing entirely to find treatments and cures for diseases for which you don't even know the cause. Are the causes of colic known, or is there more than one cause?
There's absolutely more than one cause, and like I said, it's kind of a blanket term, but the horse GI tract is a pretty complicated system, and so there's a lot of different things. Some problems can go wrong in the stomach. I mentioned ulcers, for example. Problems can go wrong in the small intestine. Problems can go wrong. Horses have a big, large colon that can move around a lot in the abdomen. It can get stuck places where it shouldn't be, and sometimes need surgery to get that fixed. Sometimes it can twist. So there's many, many different causes of colic, and that's one of the reasons we've certainly gotten a lot better at treating colic. And much of the work, like I mentioned at that colic symposium, is devoted to better surgical techniques and doing a better job with horses once we identify that they need surgery, how to get them fixed better. Because as you can imagine, it's no small undertaking to get a horse through a procedure like that. But now it's, just like I mentioned, prognosis has gotten better in foals. Prognosis has also gotten way better in horses with colic. And so we do a much better job. And I mean, we by all... equine surgeons do a much better job of treating horses with colic, and it's no longer the death sentence it used to be. In fact, I would say overall, probably depending upon the cause of colic, probably 3/4 of them that go to surgery can be okay. And for some things, it's upwards of 90%. So for some things, it's down a little bit lower. It just depends upon what that specific problem is.
Yeah. So if you're talking about a disease which is not kind of a monolithic thing, but in fact is a variety of different things, I assume that people like yourself who really study these things closely, you wouldn't just say to one of your colleagues, oh, this horse has colic. You would probably describe the specific kind of problem, right?
Absolutely.
Okay, so when you break it down into the individual sort of varieties of this disease, are there some that are still mysterious?
Sure, and I think that there's some horses that have like intermittent colic that we never really figure out what the problem is, and so there's certainly that category where we never know, and then there's a lot more that we know what it is, but we don't know why it happened. And so I would almost put the not knowing into two categories of not knowing anything at all about why that problem is occurring versus knowing what it is, knowing how to fix it, but not knowing how to prevent it.
Yeah. So what do you do? I mean, if you don't know what the cause is, if you can recognize that it is this kind of colic, but you can't put your finger on what's causing it, I mean, where do you begin?
So that's a great question. I think that's where a lot of the research starts. And so a lot of times in a problem like that, we'll start with what we call a retrospective study, which is where we take a bunch of cases that have had that problem and then take what we call a control case. So we'll look at all the records of, say, if we had 300 horses that had this particular type of large colon colic. So we take those 300 records, and then we take 300 records from a control horse that came from the same area that has similar environmental conditions. And then we look back and see what's different between the ones that got that problem and the ones that didn't. And so that's like a case-controlled retrospective study. And so then you take that and you look at, you can go back and do some statistical things like regression analyses and whatnot. And I won't bore the readers by going into much of the detail on that. But you go through and you figure out, well, wow, a horse that is a cribber. And so if you don't know what that is, that's a horse, it's a kind of a vice where horses will bite on a fence and kind of suck in air. We found out through those types of studies that horses that are cribbers have a way higher risk of a particular type of colic in general, and then specifically a type of colic called epiploic foramen entrapment, which is where some small intestine gets stuck in a random little hole in the abdomen called the epiploic foramen. And so without research going kind of working our way back into that, we wouldn't have known that that association occurred. And that usually starts with a question that where the surgeons notice that, hey, the last two or three horses with this problem also were cribbers. And so then you start to look to see if, is that just coincidence or is that real? And then it's important that you have control animals in situations like that, because it's easy to introduce bias into those situations. And, you know, we all like to think we're right, but it's important to have controls to make sure that we don't know, we're not introducing our own biases into that that situation. And that's just why, like, when you look at clinical trials, it's really important that those are blinded and randomized. And so much of the work that I've been talking about, like the work in rhodococcus, the work in anhidrosis, all of that work was in blinded clinical trials, so that the people doing the examining didn't know which treatment those animals were getting.
This is absolutely fascinating. And for the sake of listeners who might not have as much of a science background, and I'll count myself in that group, can you sort of just explain briefly an overview of how scientific research is conducted? That is to say, you have your control group, you have the group which you're giving the actual new treatment or what have you, and how you are, and scientists like you are able to kind of do this in a way that prevents bias, but also helps you find answers.
I can, sure. And I will, I'll preface that by saying I am not a statistician or an epidemiologist, but I work with a lot of good folks that are. And so there's a variety of different types of studies that one, on which one can embark. And so kind of the gold standard for looking at treatments and interventions of any type is the randomized controlled trial. And so a lot of times you hear about those on the news, usually when drugs are going to market for whatever, there's a randomized controlled clinical trial where you get patients with a certain problem, naturally occurring problem, and then you give them the treatment or the intervention indicated, whether it's a drug, whether it's a type of surgery, whether it's whatever it is, and then a placebo. That and usually this is happening in something where we don't really know what's better. And so the placebo can be either like kind of the classic sugar pill or the equivalent, or the treatment can, the placebo can be whatever the current standard of care is. And so there's some situations like where we know that this is working and we want to know if something else is better. And so you don't want to take a life-threatening situation and give them nothing, but you want to know if this other drug is, we think it might be better, but we don't know if it's better. And so the control in that situation can be the current standard of care treatment. And so, but you want to know the people that are looking at whatever X, Y, or Z outcome is aren't going to be affected by the outcome. So that's when it's blinded. And in people, it's double blinded. So the person that's taking the drug doesn't know what it is, and the doctor that's checking them doesn't know what it is. The veterinary version of double blinded is that the owner doesn't know what it is and the veterinarian doesn't know what it is. The dog or horse or whatever probably doesn't care what it is.
Right.
So it's okay to tell them, but you probably shouldn't. And so then you go through and see the outcomes and then take a look and see what the difference is between those groups.
And when all of this information is sort of put together, I mean, we're talking sometimes years before this can really be compiled and analyzed and inspected for what really is effective and what really isn't.
Sure. And so a lot of research, like I said, kind of at the start of the show, is research happens in baby steps. And so that the kind of the gold standard is the randomized controlled trial. But a lot of times we don't even know how to get to placebo, you know, what the best thing is. And so you start by, like I said, for the retrospective study. So we take 100 horses with X problem. So whether that's a type of colic like ileal impaction or whatever X problem is, and then go back and look at the records and say, oh, well, they're more likely to do this or this or this. And then you can maybe do the next step is to do a trial saying, okay, well, this seemed to be a risk factor. Well, let's take that away from this horses and see if it makes a difference in whether or not they're getting this problem down the line. And so a lot of times we can use the retrospective studies to then design what we call prospective studies. So retrospective is looking backwards at this happened, why did it happen? Prospective is I'm doing this, is it going to happen? And so then a lot of times we'll take the either the case study or the retrospective, which is just looking at one or two or a series of cases, or a retrospective study that's looking at more, to then formulate our questions, formulate some sort of intervention, and then do a prospective trial going forward. The other, and so that's all in animals with naturally occurring disease. Sometimes we look at models or look at normal healthy horses and give them drugs to look at safety of a given intervention. So sometimes before you do something to a sick horse, you want to see how it's going to behave in a healthy horse. And so that's why then we'll have, normal healthy horses and give them those things, see how they do. Obviously, we watch them really closely. And all, I was a little bit remiss in starting this talk without saying that all the work we do is all governed by University of Florida has a huge institutional animal care and use committee that makes sure that the animals are being treated humanely and safely, and we're not doing particularly painful things without having pain management. And so we all of our any sort of research we do is very tightly regulated by that university committee, and all of the journals in which we publish our work have very high ethical standards, and we have to say what the protocol number is and that our work was approved by our local committee and whatnot. And then if we use clinical animals, then there's even another committee to say that on client-owned animals that this has been approved and it's not likely to hurt them. And we have to get informed donor consent and all of those sorts of things. So there's a lot of checks and balances to make sure that what we're doing is going to be okay by the horse.
I wonder if in your work in studying some of these problems, and maybe even broadly speaking, your colleagues studying other different problems, if you ever feel frustrated by the incremental steps, that you don't see quick results, you don't get quick answers, and you may study a problem for years and years and only move a little bit forward.
Absolutely. We all wish we could have the quick fix, but unfortunately, most of life doesn't happen that way. And so, most of research happens with us banging our heads against the wall and trying to do better every day. And I think that's what keeps us going and keeps us motivated. And it's the tiny little incremental steps forward. And every once in a while, you find out something that's really cool. And then that just is invigorating and gets us all excited about doing more and learning more to get things better.
I mean, you at least as a surgeon get to have the satisfying experience of regularly operating on horses that do get better, and then they trot on out of there, and then you've done something great.
I'm actually not a surgeon.
Okay, I'm sorry.
But I do internal medicine, so I see the good work of our surgeons, but all of what I do is internal medicine. So,
okay.
But same concept.
Yeah, I mean, animals are getting better, and where you work, I mean, things are happening. Horses are getting better. That is a satisfying thing, right? I mean, so there's this two-sided aspect of this kind of work, and that is that in the clinics, animals are treated, they get better. But on the other hand, there is this research that moves slowly, but out of necessity, right? Because you can't just capriciously kind of go about this sort of business without potentially having dangerous things happen or results will not be accurate. And this is the whole thing about science that I think the public maybe, and I'd count myself among the public in this respect, we don't necessarily fully understand science in the way perhaps we all ought to, right? It's a world in which, you know, many people are engaged. We hear talk all the time everywhere about scientists this and scientists that. And there is no just one thing called science. It's so many different specialized things and so many different people are working at this. And it all is a little bit mysterious to me. And yet when you kind of lay it out and say, okay, well, we'll find ourselves in the position of noticing, hey, this horse had this problem, but we noticed that it also did this one thing. Those sorts of kind of aha, eureka moments, right? Is that generally how these answers come about?
Sometimes. And I think, you know, one of the ways I look at what is science, I think it's a way of thinking. And so I personally, if I'm going to do anything with somebody's trusting me with the care of their animal, I want to do things that are based upon data, if at all possible. And so I think that it's the mindset of what do the data show me? What do I know? What do I not know? Where can I meet in the middle? And I think that's the scientific thought process is a very data-driven basis. And so I think that that's one of the ways to look at it. And there's, you know, tons of types of research that, you know, I haven't even gotten into. There's a fantastic equine genetics lab here at UF that's looking into the genetic approach to all sorts of diseases. There's stuff looking at osteoarthritis, and there's all sorts of types of research. We've talked mostly about the things in which I'm interested because I'm talking, but there's all sorts of other aspects of equine research and done by folks all over the world. And, you know, I think that we can all be experts in our one little area and incrementally work for the betterment of the horse. And most of that gets done. You know, I think the other thing that is important for the listeners to think about is all of this stuff costs money. And there's a lot more money in research that has impact on people than there is for research that has impact on horses. Rightfully so, don't get me wrong. Human health is clearly going to always be more important in the grand scheme of things, but equine health is important too. And so we rely, I think a lot of equine researchers get a lot done with a little amount of money. And there are certain foundations out there that fund work in horses. There's Grayson Jockey Club Research Foundation that works on trying to improve the health of racehorses. There's breed associations like the American Quarter Horse Foundation. There's Morris Animal Foundation that funds work in really all companion animals, so dogs, cats, horses, those sorts of things. And then there's also, you know, a variety of different private foundations and other things like that. And so, you know, we kind of all work to ask questions. And then one of the other checks and balances to kind of make sure we're asking kind of the right questions is, in order to get money from any of those foundations, we have to write grants. And then those grants are reviewed by other scientists to say, are you doing right by your animal subjects? So are you using enough animals or too many animals or not enough animals? Because you don't want to put animals through stuff if you're not going to have a good chance at actually answering the question. And so, all of the grants we put in go through pretty extensive analysis to make sure our research design is okay, our statistical analysis is okay, our methods are okay. And if not, they'll, you know, we don't get money to do things. And so that's kind of another check.
I hate to say it, but we're almost right up against the clock. In about a minute, we're going to have to wrap it up. But briefly, can you say that you're optimistic about the future of research into a lot of these problems?
Sure. I think we've, in the last few decades, we've made tremendous strides. You know, we've got a West Nile vaccine in horses that we didn't have 15 years ago. We've got also, you know, the many of the cool findings that we've discussed on this topic. There's tons of new stuff for arthritis, stem cells, that kind of thing, everything else. So, yeah.
I'm so glad to hear it. Dr. Chris Sanchez from the UF College of Veterinary Medicine, thank you so much for coming back to the show.
My pleasure. Thanks for listening.
I want to say thanks to Richard Drake and Glenn Richards. Thank you to Sarah Carey and her staff at the Vet College. I'm Dana Hill. We'll be back next time with another episode of Animal Airwaves Live. Bye-bye.